Thank you very much, John. Thank you to ASIC for the invitation to take part in this annual event. And good afternoon. The title of this session is Australia as a Global Citizen. And so what I would like to do is to try to set financial and regulatory developments in Australia into a global setting. So this is going to be a talk about regulation, not about monetary policy. Sorry to disappoint those of you who may have hoped otherwise. I think this is worth doing for its own sake because our own discussion locally is better informed if we can see how the various initiatives that are underway fit into a broader setting. It's also important to remember that Australia, along with all jurisdictions that sign up to international standards, will be evaluated by our peers. So it's worth spelling out, at least at a very high level, our approach. In addition, from the end of this year, Australia will have responsibility for chairing the G20 for a year. And financial reform and regulation have been very prominent in the G20's agenda over recent years. So, given that our political leadership will have that responsibility for a brief period, it's worth, I think, starting to think about how that responsibility might be carried out. As a global citizen, quote unquote, Australia has the responsibilities and rights of that citizenship. The responsibilities are to uphold and play by the rules that are globally agreed, and that includes implementing global standards in regulation and oversight, and encouraging others to do so. The rights we have as a global citizen are the same as those of other citizens, and that is to have our say, to play our own part, however modest that may be, in the development of these global standards. Actually, something that is a little new and refreshing is that Australia has now a somewhat bigger place at some of the more relevant tables than we used to have. Now, ASIC, of course, has long been a member of IOSCO, as were its predecessor organisations. And I must say it's quite a feather in the cap for ASIC and for you, Greg, that you've taken over the chair of the IOSCO board, so congratulations and good luck on that. More broadly, the expanded membership of the Basel Committee for Bank Supervision, which is a very long-standing standard setter since the mid-1970s, now allows Australia two seats, and they're occupied by APRA naturally and by the Reserve Bank. The Financial Stability Board, in its expanded membership, now allows us two seats as opposed to one earlier, and also membership of some of the key committees. So we at least have some opportunity to at least have our view heard where we have a view to put in these international fora. So let me then talk about how the international financial landscape and the regulatory landscape has changed. This is going to be high level, not detailed, because some of the other Australian regulatory agencies have been more involved in the detail than the RBA, but I think it's worth having a high-level snapshot. In the wake of the crisis that swept the North Atlantic countries, the regulatory environment has changed a lot. The expanded Financial Stability Board, with the political backing of the G20 leaders, has acted to coordinate this process, working with the existing standard-setting bodies and also developing its own processes. And there are several key streams, as you would know, to these reforms. The first one is Basel III, which aims to improve the resilience of banks by strengthening capital and liquidity. And so minimum capital ratios are higher. There's a more demanding standard for definition of capital to make it focus only on genuinely loss-bearing instruments. And there's contemplation of counter-cyclical add-ons to capital as well. And that's all supplemented by a simple leverage ratio. There's more attention on liquidity management by banks. So that's an important stream of work, and that's been brought in over the past couple of years. The second key stream of work is to address the so-called problem of too big to fail, or at the global level, systemically important financial institutions, or G-SIFIs. Those institutions have been identified. There is a process of identifying who they are based on reasonably objective criteria. And there will be capital surcharges to strengthen their resilience, and that will begin in 2016. There are also cross-border crisis management and resolution groups that are being established, and of course their task is to review and hopefully improve the resolution plans that the banks themselves have drawn up. The intensity of supervision of these entities is also being increased. There's a domestic counterpart to the G-SIB framework, so there's a domestic SIFI framework as well. Banks are not the only focus here. There is a process underway to identify systemically important insurance companies, and sometime this year we'll see the details of the identification methodology to be used there. So that's the G-SIFI component. A third element is involved or is aimed at improving the functioning of markets for over-the-counter derivatives so as to reduce contagion risks that might otherwise exist in the financial system. That's to be achieved by promoting or mandating more in the way of central clearing of derivatives, and also by adding to transparency through reporting of trades and so on. A fourth stream of work is aimed at addressing the risks from shadow banking, so-called, and these are institutions or activities which are outside the regulated banking system but which combine usually credit intermediation of some kind with maturity transformation. So they do bank-like things. The Financial Stability Board released key proposals last year for consultation, and they're being refined on the basis of feedback ready to be considered at the G20 Leaders Summit later this year. So that's the four main streams of the regulatory reform agenda at an international level. So what has Australia done? Well, we weren't as badly affected, as you know, by the crisis as a number of other countries. The banking system overall, hardly without blemish, but stood up actually pretty well through that period. And that was, I think, testament to generally sound management of the institutions themselves and to a robust supervisory framework. But there were lessons from the crisis for Australia, and the regulators here have given careful thought to them and to how we might implement the associated global reforms. APRA finished its prudential standards for Basel III late last year, and Australia, along with 10 other jurisdictions, has adopted Basel III as from January 1st this year. There are some major jurisdictions, the EU and the US among them, who are running a little behind here, though all member jurisdictions had at least released draft regulations by mid-February this year. Australia then is considered an early adopter of the Basel III reforms. Given the relatively good capital positions of our banks presently, even under the stronger capital definitions that Basel III will bring in, APRA is requiring deposit takers here to meet a number of the main capital measures 2 or 3 years earlier than the rather relaxed and extended timetable required under Basel III. And it's not using some of the discretions available to provide concessional treatment for certain items in calculating capital. And that's really, I think, a reflection of how strong the capital position of our banks is. APRA has also moved ahead in building a liquidity standard, and this they've done in conjunction with the RBA. And I'd like to say one or two things about this because there's been some ill-informed commentary about this. We have established a committed liquidity facility, a mechanism under which the Basel III liquidity requirements can be met by Australian banks in a world in which government debt in Australia is relatively scarce in comparison to the case in other jurisdictions. So let me say a bit about this. It's not a bailout facility for banks. A bailout usually is where public money has been put in to inject capital to an institution whose solvency is in question or whose capital adequacy is below par. The committed liquidity facility doesn't do any such thing. It's a facility for which the institutions concerned will pay a fee and which would provide, if needed, cash against high-quality collateral pledged by institutions that APRA and the RBA judge to be solvent. The fee structure is designed to replicate the costs the institutions would incur if there was enough government debt for them to hold to meet the liquidity standard. There'd be a yield give up there, and the standing fee on the facility is designed to replicate that yield give up. Of course, there isn't enough government debt for them to hold, so that's why we have to have this system. Indeed, if we're to meet the global standard, we either have something like the CLF, or we have the federal government issue a few hundred billion dollars in extra debt for the banks to hold. The relevant ADIs will pay a fee of 15 points a year to have this facility available whether or not they use it. If they do use it, the funding will be at the market rate plus 25 basis points penalty. So it's not cheap funding, it's not a bailout, and it's constructed in a way to meet the required international standard given Australia's unique conditions of low government debt. It's been developed openly and with scrutiny of the international regulatory community, and it was approved by the Reserve Bank Board in November of 2010. So that's the liquidity side and the Basel rules. With regard to the so-called SIFI reforms for systemic institutions, well, our banks can't realistically be assessed as globally systemic, so there was no reason for them to be caught in that particular framework. But it's impossible to deny that locally or domestically they're systemic, and so it's appropriate that the Basel Committee's domestic SIFI framework will capture our major institutions. That will involve some additional loss absorbency on capital. It will also involve an intensity of supervision greater than applied to the average deposit taker, something which, in fact, already is a key part of APRA's approach to supervision. In the area of resolution, a number of steps have been taken over the past few years to strengthen APRA's crisis management powers, and there are some other powers, including some of the RBA, being strengthened. I'll come back to that. So far as derivatives markets are concerned, legislation was passed late last year in Australia to help meet emerging international standards. Now, given that the actual implementation of these standards in major jurisdictions is still not final, and so there's some uncertainty around the shape of that, the legislative framework in Australia contains, at this point, considerable flexibility. It does not directly introduce trade reporting or central clearing or any trade execution obligations for OTC derivatives. What it does do is create a mechanism by which such obligations may be implemented when needed by supporting regulations that would be developed and administered by ASIC. Now, there is a focus generally more widely on what is these days known as FMIs, financial market infrastructures, by which we mean central counterparties and other forms of high-value clearing and settlement systems. And the Committee on Payment and Settlement Systems and IOSCO released some new principles here last year after 2 years of detailed work on standard setting. In response to that, the Reserve Bank has revised its own financial stability standards for central counterparties and securities settlement facilities so as to align with the new principles. We've also committed to assessing our main high-value payment system, RITS, which we own and operate, against these principles on an annual basis. ASIC has similarly updated its regulatory guide for clearing and settlement facility licensees to reflect the new principles, and it aims to ensure consistency with these principles in the regime it's designing for trade repositories. On shadow banking, this is an area where the Reserve Bank presents an annual review of shadow banking developments to the Council of Financial Regulators. Our assessment is that shadow banking in Australia is relatively small in comparison to the established and regulated ADI sector, at least by the comparisons of shadow banking systems in other countries. That means that the shadow banking recommendations that are being developed perhaps won't bind or be quite as important for us as they would be in some other jurisdictions, at least at the moment. Separately from that, of course, there's the question of investor protection in the shadow banking sphere, and here ASIC and APRA, as you know, are working on strengthening the regulatory framework for things like retail debentures. So that's the sorts of high-level things that Australia has been doing. Some of these things remain a work in progress, of course, as they are elsewhere, but there's a lot going on. And it's obvious that although internationally a lot has been achieved in the past 4 or 5 years, significant challenges remain. It is, I think, fair to say that as time has passed and as implementation has come more into focus, the difficulties and complications are now coming to the fore. We're seeing some aspects of the Basel standards adjusted already, particularly in the liquidity space. It's been necessary for some of the standard-setting bodies to issue additional guidance and to provide additional clarity around the new reforms, and to try to ensure consistency in interpretation and implementation. Now, to some extent, I think this is to be expected. Reforms which seemed so obvious, so simple, so bold and sweeping immediately post the crisis in 2008 or 9 have turned out to be more difficult and more complex to implement than might have been first expected. I think that's hardly surprising because so much is being attempted at the same time and in a relatively short space of time. It isn't that attempting a lot is a mistake, it's necessary. There were significant problems, there's a lot to be done, and so there was no choice really but to try to address a number of things simultaneously. But in doing that, there was always, I think, a good chance that the compounding effects of multiple reforms would contain some unexpected and unintended consequences. To take only one example, one more could be given, but to take one, there's a concern now in some quarters about a potential shortage of high-quality collateral in markets. And that arises because regulatory reforms around bank liquidity and around centralised clearing are likely to add to demand for high-quality liquid assets, even at a time when government credit ratings are going down and it's not clear what the quality of some of these assets might be. So that's in turn triggering great interest by some financial intermediaries in offering collateral transformation services, that is, turning somewhat more risky assets into ostensibly safer ones in order to meet this demand for high quality collateral. Well, that activity itself could well bring in additional new risks. So this, among other things, is something that needs to be watched. The OTC derivatives reforms have been a particularly thorny issue, not least because of the cross-jurisdictional reach of regulation from some of the major jurisdictions in this area. The European regulation and US regulation are clear examples of measures that potentially at least have a strong impact on other jurisdictions. In response to that, a group of regulators, including ASIC, has been convened to develop some common understandings regarding the cross-border application of these rules. That's a very important work that's still in progress. In this particular space, given how global the market for OTC derivatives is, consistency in design of rules and in implementation across jurisdictions obviously is key. Now, as derivatives markets make this transition towards central clearing, interest is emerging from overseas-based central counterparties in providing their services into Australia. Many international participants in Australian interest rate swaps, which is probably the most important derivative that we're talking about here, already clear their trades through LCH ClearNet. LCH has announced that it will be seeking a license to provide these services directly to Australian participants, and that will be alongside a competing offering by the domestic counterparty ASX Clear. These are all quite important developments. To the extent that participants in smaller markets choose to clear via overseas-based CCPs, it's important that they can do so on appropriate terms, and also that the interests of regulators in the smaller jurisdictions be given due consideration. And that's why last year ASIC and the RBA released some work setting out the sorts of measures that we think are appropriate to ensure adequate regulatory influence where an overseas-based central counterparty might operate in Australia. And they would be applied in the case of LCH or any other overseas-based central counterparty that might be given a license to operate here. An additional factor in a world of more central clearing is the question of how the official sector might deal with a situation of FM, or financial market infrastructure, distress. That actually becomes a lot more important if we're driving far more activity onto central counterparties. We are actually creating a number of single points of potential failure. So we need to think about how a situation where one of these entities came under duress might be managed. As a result of a review by the Council of Financial Regulators 2 years ago, work is in progress to develop legislative proposals that would effectively give a step-in power to the relevant regulators in Australia as part of a comprehensive resolution regime for FMIs. And that will be designed to be in accordance with international standards. So these are just a couple of areas in which the international regulatory work program is becoming more complex. Whether it's the additional demand for high-quality collateral that arises from reforms on bank liquidity and centralised clearing, whether it's the extraterritorial reach of Dodd-Frank or the equivalent European legislation, whether it's even the likely difficulties of maintaining a system of reference interest rates in a world where banks are very wary of the legal risk involved in giving an opinion about where they think the market might be, or whether it's the likelihood that some risk-taking activities will migrate beyond the regulatory perimeter, the complications arising from regulatory activism, I think, increasingly are in evidence. My guess is we don't yet know what all the compounding effects of multiple reforms may be, and it may be some years before we do know. A principle that the Reserve Bank, for its part at least, has sought to uphold in our own participation in the various work streams is that we should proceed certainly with all due urgency where that's needed, but equally with deliberate care wherever that is possible, being conscious of the limits to our own knowledge and the likelihood of unintended consequences from the steps that we might take. Let me turn then to thinking further ahead. As I've said, the financial reform agenda internationally post-2008 has been very large and very comprehensive, and it's ongoing. It's worth thinking about how to manage this into the future, particularly given the G20 chairmanship coming our way towards the end of this year. Now, of course, it's inappropriate to talk in too much detail here. The Russian presidency of the G20 is in full swing. That will remain the case until at least November. And our job until then is to assist them in bringing a successful conclusion to that presidency. On the financial regulatory side, the Russian chair has to date focused on having the G20 work towards completion and implementation of previously announced reforms. And obviously, from what I've said, I'd very much agree with that. That is a multi-year task, and we will inherit that next year. Another area that the Russian presidency has identified for attention is the possible effects of regulatory reforms on the supply of long-term financing, given that one of their key interests is in promoting long-term financing for investment and infrastructure. Now, the FSB has done some work on this and to date found little evidence that the regulatory reforms thus far have significantly affected the availability of long-term finance, but the FSB has been asked to keep a weather eye on this, and that makes sense. Australia's approach to the G20, of course, will be not dictated by me or by the Reserve Bank. It'll be a national approach, ultimately decided and adopted by the government. Subject to and respecting that constraint, I would simply make the observation that I think by 2014, we will have reached a point in the financial regulatory space where the G20 should be looking for careful and sustained efforts at implementation of reforms that are already agreed, but it should be wary of adding further reforms to that work program. Absent some new major development which shows up some regulatory failing that we hadn't hitherto seen, I think it would be risk overload to task the regulatory community with further major changes at this point. Now, lest you think that that's too weak a position, just remember how many things, how many work streams are underway, how much is being attempted, and how much of that remains yet to be completed. And since we're already seeing the need to tweak some of the reforms which had been agreed, and in the Basel space, the liquidity rules is a case in point, surely it's clear that implementation should be our feature, our focus over the next few years. The G20 will, I think, also need to remain open to the possibility, perhaps even likelihood, that as experience is gained with implementation, and as we grapple with the inevitable difficulties that will come up there, and as we learn more about how the financial system will work under the new rules, we will occasionally want to make some adjustments to those rules. None of that should be seen as a retreat in any way from the high-level objectives of all this, and those objectives, in my view, are the desire to see a more stable, more resilient, and in many respects simpler financial system, one that is better able and more inclined to play its role as the handmaiden of industry, and one that is better able to withstand the failure of individual institutions. But in pursuing those goals, I think it's important to keep a few principles in mind. The first is to strike the right balance between more regulation and more effective enforcement of existing regulation. And there's no doubt, I think, that inadequate enforcement of regulation was at least as big a problem as deficient rules in the lead up to the crisis. Secondly, we need to keep in mind the cross-border aspects of the financial system with the associated need for cooperation and occasionally compromise. Recognition of the legitimate interests of smaller markets, clearly that's important for Australia, but it is actually for many jurisdictions. That will often coincide with pushing for a principles-based approach rather than a heavy-handed, detailed, rules-based one. It might also involve working with regional colleagues to develop a regional voice on some issues, something that I think we probably could usefully see more of in our own region. And thirdly, the third principle to keep in mind is to consider the combination of the reforms in their entirety, to keep a lookout for unintended consequences. Given the breadth and the speed of the reforms over recent years, careful analysis, even though it's hard to do, of how the various initiatives will interact is becoming more important. So, in conclusion, keeping the regulatory structure fit for purpose across a broad range of jurisdictions around the world is a big task, and it's one actually that will never be complete. That's because the financial system evolves. It evolves in response to technology and innovation. It also evolves in response to regulation itself. It's important then for Australia not only to keep abreast of the developments and implement the key elements of global regulation here, but to continue to play our own modest part in helping develop those regulations and refining them in the light of experience. Thank you very much for your attention. I'm happy to take a few questions.
John Trowbridge. Glenn, when you began, you described the banking, you talked about the Basel Committee and the IAI and the IOSCO. You didn't make any reference to the IAIS and the... is there anything to be added about the insurance component of the international regulatory environment?
The IAIS, is the insurance guys are working on their own version of GSIFI, or GSIIs as it's called, and I think it's fair to say that is less advanced than the banking work, but it is coming along, and I think sometime during this year we're going to see more in the way of public details about that framework. I think enough of that is still a little bit under wraps, at least from me, that's all I can say, but there's certainly an insurance component here. I thought I mentioned that, but the IAIS is certainly front and centre in developing that.
Glenn, it's Alex Erskine from ASIC. You said something the other day that was well reported in at least one paper about high-frequency trading, and you didn't see a lot of value in that. But I wonder if you either want to say something along, about high-frequency trading or about the European financial transaction tax proposals.
I think what I said about high-frequency trading was that it was possible at some point, if we're down to making sure the cables that connect the computers are all the same length so that nobody gets a nanosecond advantage, you might begin at some point to wonder about the social return. That is not to say that there's no place for high-frequency trading, and I think ASIC has put out some very useful things on that, which no doubt you had a hand in writing, Alex, so very good work. So I don't have anything to add to that. Your other question was the transaction tax. Well, this is an idea that's been around for a long time. I think, in my mind at least, the relevant question is to what place the activity will migrate once such a tax comes in, unless you've put it in everywhere, and I think the prospects for getting all the other jurisdictions to engage in that, I would not have thought they're that high. That said, they appear to be intent on bringing it in, so we will get a real-life experiment, and no doubt we'll learn a lot from that. Mr. Lasker.
Phil Lasker from ABC. A Cyprus question. I just wanted to know what you think of the current deal. Your colleague, the deputy governor, wasn't too pleased a week or so ago, but we see the final touches at this point of a deal. Does it, do you think, risk undermining confidence in the banking sector because of the because of what happens to deposits? And other analysis that I've seen, which is given a bit of momentum by the Dutch finance minister, suggests that it could be a blueprint. Do you think it represents some sort of turning point where the EU sees banks able to foot the bill partly for bailouts, and they're now going to attack the banks directly to foot some of that bill?
Well, I think the reconstructed deal as I understand it, in the past day or so, is a better one than the initial proposal, and I think the initial proposal was the one to which the Deputy Governor was expressing some surprise, shall we say, that insured deposits faced a haircut. That was certainly, I thought, a novel approach to resolving the banking problem. So I think the present proposal is considerably improved on that. It's very difficult to predict, I think, how they will go. We're not going to know until the banks reopen in a few days' time. But they're in a better place now than they were in some days back. As for whether this is a blueprint or a template, I had understood that the Dutch finance minister issued a clarification of that to say, well, that isn't really what I meant. Actually, I think if you look at the... We've had a number of programs now. You know, we had Ireland, we had Greece, Portugal, Spain, Cyprus. They're all actually a bit different. So I'm not sure that any one of them is clearly a template. I suspect the Europeans will still be somewhat case-specific as they deal with these things.
Governor Stevens, Jonathan Shapiro from the Financial Review. I'd like to ask you your views on how the slowing nominal economy is affecting government revenue, as the Treasury has pointed out. Do you think this will continue, and what does this mean for the fiscal balance and how you incorporate this into monetary policy?
Well, Jonathan, yes, the nominal economy affects tax revenues. That's correct. I also think that estimating the elasticity between the two is a very difficult task, and fortunately that is the task of the Treasury, not of me. And I don't really have any comment about fiscal policy today.
Glenn, we had a discussion yesterday about the corporate bond market in Australia, and it's quite interesting because one of the speakers was from Malaysia, where, as you probably know, they've developed quite a strong corporate bond market. In fact, they pointed out that the funding for the economy apparently is coming more from the corporate bond market, debt market, than from the equity markets, which is quite interesting. You know, we've been trying to get our bond market going for a number of years, and I think there's demand and supply issues there. But I'm just wondering whether... I know that with your eligible committed liquidity facility, I don't think at the moment that includes potentially corporate bonds. I think it's mainly government bonds, if I'm correct.
It's actually going to be very much around RMBS.
That's
because there's not enough government.
So, in fact, it is going to take into the move into. But I think, is there anything else do you think that we could be doing to try and unlock more, having more funding coming from corporate bonds as opposed from the banking sector? And it's clearly demand supply issues. Yeah. I'm not saying there's a simple solution, but I'd just be interested to get your thoughts if you have any.
Well, no, there's no simple solution. I mean, there is a corporate bond market, but it's been largely dominated by the banks as issuers to date, which is, I mean, that's obviously not achieving the diversification of funding for the economy. Well, what do you need from market? You need some issuers and some lenders, and I guess we need to think about whether there are any unnecessary impediments there. It strikes me still that a lot of this is kind of hysteretic. It's based on the US market is there, it's incredibly big and liquid, and the issuers just naturally want to go there because of that. And that it's that way because it's been that way. And I think it's hard to combat that. But so I don't have any particular magic solutions for developing a corporate bond market. It's probably going to take time. But I would have thought, given a pool of savings and given some high-quality issuers, in principle, there's no reason that can't develop.
Just one comment that came out yesterday was how potentially can you unlock liquidity from the superannuation sector? And one of the issues that came up is that the superannuation sector, clearly with the with member choice, they are clearly concerned about liquidity. I guess one of the issues is how you can actually try to unlock that in terms of having something that is liquid. It's a bit of a chicken and egg, frankly. So.
It is, because super funds can't borrow, which makes them, I think, hard to do repos, which means they've got a liquidity issue. But you'd have to talk to the regulator of super funds, perhaps, not me, about that. Thanks, John.